It is Friday, June the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, illegal immigrants being dispersed across U.S.
Not uncommon among adults. It is surprising that this is happening also with children.
A crucial election Sunday for Turkey.
The election is going to take place under extraordinary law, the state of emergency, which is continuing in the last 2 years.
A new idea to bring food to one less privileged U.S. community, plus a little something from the world of music. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump has visited a child immigrant detention center in McAllen, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Her trip to the area was unannounced, and it came a day after President Trump reversed a policy of separating migrant families at the southern border. Mrs. Trump spoke about the reasons for her visit.
We all know they're here without their families. And I want to thank you for your hard work, your compassion, and your kindness you're giving them in these difficult times. I'm here to learn about your facility, and which I know you house children on a long-term basis. And I also like to ask you how I can help to these children to reunite with their families
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security Chief Kirstjen Nielsen said there is a plan to reunite the more than 2,000 children who have been detained apart from their parents so far. Meanwhile, VOA's Aline Barros is at an immigration court hearing in McAllen. She said prosecutors dropped misdemeanor charges against 17 migrants. The migrants who were separated from their children remained detained, but dropping the charges could be a means to reunite them and allow the families to be detained together.
We got to the federal courthouse here in McAllen. We were waiting to, you know, people allowed us to enter and see the hearings and take notes. The gentleman from the Texas Civil Rights Project comes out and says, "We're done for today. The cases have been dismissed." And we said, "Well, what do you mean the cases have been dismissed?" And he says that their criminal misdemeanor legal entry for 17 families that they were able to speak with were dropped. The prosecutors did not pursue them. And we asked why, and he said that that's the information they had, and the prosecutors don't have to tell them why they did not pursue, but they just dropped the cases.
Is it known then what will happen now? Will they be reunited with their children?
So that's what it's unclear, because the children are under ORR care, right? And the ORR care, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and ICE and DHS, they don't share the same system. So it's unclear yet what's going to happen. We asked this gentleman from the Texas Civil Rights Project. His name is Efren Olivares. And he said that the parents most likely will go back to an immigration detention center. But he does not know, and he cannot tell if the children will be taken there, will be reunited with the parents. The job of this gentleman is to speak with the parents who had their children taken away from them, have all their information, and make sure they're keeping tracking of those cases, because otherwise only the U.S. government knows who they separated from who.
Because there have been reports, now I don't know if these children were related to the cases that you're speaking about, there have been reports that some children have been taken as far away as New York City.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Some children, and that's the discretion of the office. I mean, they can literally decide to take the people, you know, everywhere, whatever, whenever there's a space available. This is not a practice that happens with adults. You may be detained in a place like Detroit, for instance, but you may be in a detention center, in an immigration detention center here in Texas, even though you were living in Detroit. So it's not uncommon among adults. It is surprising that this is happening also with children.
Well, meanwhile, are migrants continuing to try to come into the United States?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the 17 people that the Texas Civil Rights Project interviewed today were detained on Monday and Tuesday, this past Monday and Tuesday. So, you know, and the gentleman, Olivares, actually told us, even though our work is done here for today, we'll be back tomorrow and we'll continue to come back tomorrow. But the people that they interviewed today to get their information and to get the children's information try to cross the country Monday and Tuesday.
VOA's Aline Barro, she is in McAllen, Texas, and speaking with my colleague, Sarah Williams.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
People of Turkey will be going to the polls on Sunday in one of modern Turkey's most important national elections, with both parliament and the presidency at stake at the same time, a first in Turkish history under the new constitution. It will also be a verdict on the 15-year rule of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been given a new group of executive powers. Mr. Erdogan must capture about 50% of the vote, actually more than that, to avoid a July 8th runoff. His ruling Justice and Development Party must also take more than 300 seats in the 600-seat parliament to avoid a coalition partnership. Ahmet Sozin is a political scientist and international affairs professor at Eastern Mediterranean University on Cyprus. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the outcome is crucial because Turkey matters to the world.
It is the second biggest army in NATO, so who rules Turkey really matters. So the test this time is going to be between whether people are happy with a decade and a half long rule by Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party, or whether the Turks are ready for change. But of course, the election is going to take place under extraordinary law, the state of emergency, which is continuing in the last 2 years after the coup attempt in the summer of 2016. Erdogan's party is holding the upper hand when it comes to the media coverage, because the majority of the Turkish media is mostly very friendly with Erdogan or under the control of people who are supporters of Erdogan. So the opposition is entering into this crucial election in a disadvantaged position.
Will this election turn on the first-time young voters?
I think so, because Turkey is a country with a huge population which is relatively young. So definitely the young voters are very important. We'll see how many of them or what percentage of them will actually go to the polls. The voters' turnout in Turkey has always been much higher.
Do you expect a runoff July 8th?
If the elections are going to take place in a fair and just mode, let's say, that is my expectation. We have several candidates running in the presidential election, especially, not in the parliamentary, but presidential election. The more candidates we have, the more votes will be distributed among them, and it will be very difficult for one candidate to get more than 50% of the vote in the first round.
How important is the outcome of this election to Turkey, its allies, the European Union, the U.S., and Syria?
I think that this is very important because, especially in the last few years, Turkey has been ruled in a way that there is a high polarization in the country between those who support Erdogan for the matter of stability. On the other hand, we have those who believe that this tension polarization in Turkey is very dangerous, that we need to reestablish democratic rule again. We have to uphold rule of law and democracy in Turkey and go back to the parliamentary system rather than handing substantive executive powers into the hands of one man.
The head of Turkey's Hayat Election Board said the number of Turks voting in other countries rose to a record level of nearly 1.1 and a half million. They voted between June 19th and June 7th and 19th. Domestically, there were more than 56 million eligible voters for the Sunday election. President Erdogan is running against five other presidential candidates, a network of election monitors that will also be there seeking to ensure a free, fair, and transparent ballot. Following allegations of irregularities, you might remember, in last year's constitutional referendum. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. A United Nations report on extreme poverty and human rights finds that 40 million people in the United States live in poverty, that is, 18.5 million live in extreme poverty, and more than 5 million live in conditions of what's called absolute poverty. Lisa Schlein has her report.
UN Special Rapporteur Philip Alston calls the United States the most unequal society in the developed world. He says U.S. policies benefit the rich and exacerbate the plight of the poor. He says Trump administration policies stigmatize the poor by insisting those receiving government benefits are capable of working and that benefits, such as food stamps, should be cut back significantly. He says the government's suggestions that people on welfare are lazy and do not want to work misrepresent the facts.
The statistics that are available show that the great majority of people who, for example, are on Medicaid are either working in full-time work, around half of them, or they are in school, or they are in giving full-time care to others.
He says 7% of people are not working. In his report, Alston notes the United States has the highest rate of income inequality among Western countries, with the top 1% of the population owning more than 38% of total wealth. He says the Trump administration's $1.5 trillion tax cuts overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy and will worsen the situation of the poor. The UN investigator tells VOA that at the completion of his country fact-finding missions, he issues what he calls an end-of-mission statement that, he says, gives some governments the opportunity to immediately respond.
The U.S. chose not to do that. And since then, there has not been any official response to either that end of mission statement or to the final report, which has now been out for a couple of weeks.
As is common practice, after Alston formally presents his report to the UN Human Rights Council, the concerned country has a right of reply. Though the United States has withdrawn as a member of the Council, it still has the right to respond to the report as an observer country if it wishes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Many disadvantaged neighborhoods and cities across the United States do not have a nearby grocery store, and many people who live in those neighborhoods have to take public transportation to the nearest store, and that could be several kilometers away. So the Salvation Army opened a grocery store in a low-income neighborhood that doesn't have one in Baltimore, Maryland. And as we hear now from VOA's Deborah Block, people in that area can now walk to this converted warehouse and buy quality food at low cost.
This family is shopping at the Salvation Army DMG grocery store in Baltimore, Maryland. DMG stands for Doing the Most Good, the motto of the worldwide Protestant charity organization, known for its thrift shops and food pantries in the United States. Customer Joanne Weaver is impressed with the selection and the lower-than-average grocery store prices, which helps stretch her food budget.
It's the first time I haven't had to ride more than 4 miles, because I usually go all over the place to the stores.
Catholic priest Samuel Lupico used to serve in a church in this neighborhood. He is impressed with the nutritious food, which he says will help people who usually cannot afford to make healthy meals.
And I love it because it provides an opportunity for people who don't have stores like this to shop in one without paying for transportation to get out.
Major Gene Hogg, Central Maryland commander for the Salvation Army, came up with the idea of a grocery store for people with low incomes to help them prepare healthier food.
Typically, they've been raised to buy frozen chicken and heat it up, or they stop by a McDonald's. But we can encourage them and let them taste what good, cooked, healthy food could be.
Aaron Keating came into the store for the first time.
To see any sort of company moving in that has a charitable mission, I think, is a good thing for the neighborhood. And if that mission is to supply food to people for a cheap price, I'm for it.
Most of the customers receive government food assistance. They can join a loyalty program that gives them something free each month.
Whether it's free chicken or free light bulbs, whatever we have in order to help them stretch their dollars.
The store also offers nutrition guidance, meal planning, and hires people from the neighborhood. They can learn job skills so they can work at other grocery stores. And in keeping with Salvation Army tradition,
hi, how are you doing today?
Store manager Jim Ferray says DMG also takes food to homeless shelters.
150 meals a night. So it's a grocery store, but yet it's also a social service, has a social service aspect of it.
But despite the similarities with other grocery stores, DMG has one big difference.
Our business model is really to break even, right? If we do better than that, then the proceeds from this will go to support our program called Catherine's Cottage for women who've been rescued from human trafficking.
If the experiment works, Hogue hopes more Salvation Army grocery stores will be opened in disadvantaged neighborhoods in the United States. Deborah Block, VOA News, Baltimore.
And still ahead, the sounds of Josh Groban. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
To reach the impossible dream would be to make the impossible burger. A burger made totally of non-meat products, but one that looks, smells, feels, and above all, tastes like meat. Well, the dream is alive. Meet the CFO of Impossible Foods, David Lee.
There are four major natural ingredients in the Impossible Burger. There's a protein from a wheat plant that we've all been eating for a long time. There's this protein that comes from actually a potato. It gives it its bite. It's why it can firm up when you cook it.
The burger is 100% plant-based, and Sebastian Silvestri, the CEO of Disruptive Group, a hospitality company, says it tastes like beef and will pass the blind test.
And it bleeds and it sizzles, which is really revolutionary.
Investors have poured $400 million into the Impossible Burger dream, and the goal, David Lee says, is to go global with it. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music.
Soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. strong when on your shoulders you raise me up to more than I can be.
Josh Groban is an American singer, songwriter, actor, and record producer. His first four solo albums have been certified multi-platinum, and he was charted in 2007 as the number one best-selling artist in the United States, with more than 22 million records, including You Raise Me Up. Groban was born in Los Angeles, California, originally studying acting, but moved on to singing as his voice developed. He attended the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, where students receive a conservatory-style education. The famous composer and music producer David Foster called Groban to stand in for an ailing Andrea Bocelli to rehearse a duet of the song The Prayer with Celine Dion at the rehearsal for the 1998 Grammy Awards. He amazed everyone, and still today, it's always on his playlist. Here he sings it with American singer, producer, and actor Angie Stone.
I pray you'll be our and watch us where we go, and help us to be wise in times when we don't know. Ooh, let this be our prayer.
Care to
thine. Pray we'll find your light.
El cuore estella.
And hold it in our hearts.
A ricordarci che.
The stars go out each night.
La terna stella se. Nella mia preghiera. Fede c'è.
When shadows feel our
lead us to a place.
Guide us with your grace.
Give us faith so we'll be saved.
Just about every time David Foster has a concert or a television special, Josh Groban is on the stage. The TV special Hitman David Foster and Friends featured Groban and singer-songwriter Brian McKnight singing Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water.
I'm on your side. Oh, when times get rough and friends just can't. Troubled water, I will lay me down.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Mr. Brian McKnight.
When you're down and out, when you're on the comes and pain.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a great Friday. Now a bit more from Josh Groban and Brian McKnight.
Your time has come to shine. And all your dreams are all done.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.